Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi. And yes, I just got a haircut for those of you patrons who are watching live. So with me is Armin Navabi. Armin Navabi is, as you know, the founder of Atheist Republic and the author of Why There Is No God. And today, this episode is one I've been looking forward to for quite a while. Because our guest is someone who has greatly inspired me for, I think, over 10 years now. So, and it's Maryam Namazi. Maryam Namazi, welcome to Secular Jihadists.
Hi. Great to be here. I'm really happy to be with you. Thank you for having me on the program.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. And so I just came back from the Netherlands and Belgium for a tour for the Dutch translation of my book. And over there, I was quoting you quite heavily. I think when you were talking about, I was discussing a lot about how there's a rise of atheism in the Muslim and Arab world, which I've seen with my correspondence, you've seen as well. And that's something that I definitely want to talk about, because that was something that everybody was very, very interested in. And we're going to get into some of that. But quickly, just to introduce you to the very few people who may not know, Maryam Namazi has a very long record, and long and actually pretty robust record of human rights activism. She was born in Tehran in Iran, and she came to the West. She came to the UK after her after the revolution in 1979, and since then you've done an incredible amount of work. I won't be able to get into all of it, but from working with Ethiopian refugees in Sudan to working in Turkey with refugees to founding the One Law for All organization against Sharia law, and importantly, and what we'll be focusing on today, is the Council of Ex-Muslims of Britain. And this, I think, was a pioneering organization that you started in 2007, I think, or so around then. And since then, it's grown with just thousands and thousands of members, not only in the UK, but all over the world. It has also inspired the growth of other organizations like Ex-Muslims of North America in the United States. There's Ex-Muslims of Jordan. There's Ex-Muslims of the Netherlands. You know, I was there and I saw that as well. And I met some members of that group over there as well. So it's just been a huge. But when you started, it was a small organization. Can you tell us how you started it and why you started it?
Yeah, it was very small when it started. And it started initially in Germany with Mina Ahadi. And we spoke. She's another Iranian political activist. And we spoke with each other about starting it in various countries. So I also went for the founding of the councils in Scandinavian countries too. And then in Britain, of course. So they all started a few weeks apart from each other. And in Britain, it was amazing for me because, when we started it, we were looking for people's names and faces to come out publicly to say that they're ex-Muslims in order to break the taboo that comes with leaving Islam. And it was so hard to find people who were born and raised in Britain. And that was my first lesson and the first shocking thing that I found. And if you look at the original poster, there's maybe one or two people who aren't of Iranian background. Everybody was, Iranian political activists, atheists who've been opposed to Islamic rule for many decades. Mm-hmm. So that was, the first shock. And then the other was when we had our first conference. Now, the ex-Muslims were all hiding up on a balcony. They didn't want to be photographed. They didn't want to be seen.
And this was when? When was the first conference?
It was 2007. you know, so when we had our launch and we had a conference soon after. So it has changed so much in the past 10 years, hasn't it? And it's amazing how quickly things have changed. I think social media has really helped push that along.
I
think it just showed how much fear and how much of a taboo it really is, not just in countries under Islamic rule, but in the West as well.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that we're trying to do, and this is reflected in the name of the podcast, is, you know, when we talk about the Muslim Enlightenment, and that's what I titled my my talk there as well. And there was a quote that you had, and I'm going to paraphrase it. The internet is doing to Islam today what the printing press did in the past to Christianity. And more and more, as I correspond with ex-Muslims around the world, as I've heard from people who've reached out to me from all of these sort of Muslim majority countries, especially Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Bangladesh, Malaysia, and Pakistan, and some of these include prominent journalists and, you know, prominent celebrities who are famous there, but they can't speak openly. And when I hear from them, I see more and more that is the case. The way that the printing press actually, in a way, facilitated, or you could even say was responsible in large part for the Enlightenment, and just allowed this sort of transparency of scripture that wasn't there before. I mean, that was before the Reformation. And yes, it was a long process. It was bloody. It was very violent. But ultimately, it paved the way for the freedoms and the society that we enjoy today. And I am seeing something very, very similar happening on the internet. And a few years ago, on International Human Rights Day, you had the Ex-Muslim Because campaign. And this was started by Rehana Sultan, I think. It became... I think it shocked a lot of people. So just to explain what this was ex-Muslims around the world using the hashtag ex-Muslims because they were talking about why they left Islam. And they had all kinds of amazing reasons. And there were people, there were LGBT youth in Saudi Arabia, there were feminists in Iran, there were secularists in Pakistan, they were all tweeting. And what shocked people was that it became the top trending hashtag in the UK at the time, just shortly before it launched. And I at that point, I think it even hit me how big it had become. Right?
Exactly, definitely. I mean, we were shocked ourselves, to be honest. We started it earlier than the 10th of December because we thought we would need time to get people to use the hashtag. And we were hoping for at most several thousand, and it went viral overnight, even before the actual launch of the campaign, basically. So I think it surprised all of us, even those of us who knew that there are huge numbers of atheists, you know, mm-hmm. from Islamic backgrounds.
But it was really shocking. I think the even if the goal was to introduce ex-Muslims to the world, but one of the bonuses was introducing ex-Muslims to each other, right? Like the ex-Muslims to discover how many they are. I mean, if you think about the other movements, like the gay rights movements, right? One thing that it did was not just to just go fight for their rights, but the fact that they saw each other, that they thought like, wow, there's so many of us out there and that we're not, you know, and when a lot of people that were in, you know, even a lot of people even today that are in the closet, when they're looking at other gay people that are open, that are not ashamed, they just in secret are proud and can enjoy seeing other people not having to be ashamed or scared of who they are. And I think just the numbers, just to see the numbers, even to ex-Muslims, maybe in other countries, seeing this, not even the ones that are still not ready to come out or are not able to come out, just seeing this, that there is a whole bunch of us out there, I think it's very encouraging.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the things I know you've also heard often is the fact that people say that they feel really alone, that they're the only ones, and also that there's something wrong with them. You know, even today you hear people saying that you've got a psychological problem if you're an atheist or an ex-Muslim. And so that does have that sort of effect. It does make people feel hopeful and feel that there's not something wrong with them. And I think that was hugely important. And that's why a lot of people were saying that when they were reading the hashtags, you know, some people were just bawling in front of their computers and crying and just feeling all these emotions, just because it is, you know, this wonderful feeling that you're not alone. And that has a huge psychological impact, especially when you think about the amount of people who are being shunned, who are afraid, you know, even if they're not being killed as a result, that they just feel so alone and so desperate sometimes. And this does help give hope and courage. And I think those are hugely important for any movement, you know, people feel.
Yeah, I remember, I think a few years ago, we were all watching online when there was a young man named Irtaza Hussain, who, you know, you probably know, who committed suicide. And it was just chilling. I think he was also involved with ex-Muslims of Britain, and he had problems with his family and so on. And he even put a picture on Facebook that I'll never forget this, where he was sitting on a tree branch and, you know, there was a noose around his neck, and he said something like, you know, just one jump away. And by the time they got to him, it was too late. And this was just, I think, it's just so representative of how so many ex-Muslims feel when they are, you know, abandoned. It's almost like it's like their parents. They love the ideology more than their children. Like, this is how I feel, how toxic the ideology can be, that it can really put yourself in the way of your children. And now, you know, as a father myself, I couldn't imagine anything like that. But it happens. It's very, very powerful.
So. Yeah, I mean, even in the case of Irtaza, for example, we had talked about ways in which he could leave his family and get protection. And, you know, he was really conflicted, and he decided to stay with his family. And I think, again, there's also this torment of loving your family more than you love yourself and your freedom too, for a lot of people, wanting to please them, wanting to not disappoint them, because, you know, you do fundamentally, for many of us, even if we don't agree with our families, we do really love them, want to be loved them. And I think that does cause a lot of pain as well. And as you say, the unfortunate thing is that there are families who do love their ideology, their beliefs, much more than they do love their children, which is really unimaginable, isn't
yeah.
it?
I think it shows how powerful like the virus of Islam or other religions are, to be able to go against such a powerful force of nature. I mean, I've seen a lot of people, a lot of mothers that tell their kids that they love Muhammad more than their own kids. And I've seen women celebrating their child's death because now they're in paradise. Like, they had celebrations for their son being a martyr. I mean, that's so goes against, you know, such a powerful force in nature. It must be so powerful itself to be able to achieve something like that, no?
And I also think, you know, a lot of it is this concern. I think it a lot of those of us who come from our backgrounds, this concern of what other people think, you know, and that being so paramount that it affects the rights of your kids and your the women in your families and so on and so forth. And I think that, you know, is huge, that guilt and the shame, and also worried, constantly worried, what will the neighbors say? What will our family say? And that sort of doesn't allow people to just think rationally and to make really more humane decisions. And for me, I felt like, I don't know, there was one moment in my life where I didn't feel guilty or ashamed anymore. And it's just so hugely liberating. I don't live my life thinking, what will my parents think? I mean, I do want my parents to be proud of me, obviously, but I don't live my life like that. Will the neighbors think if I dress this way, if I come home with this person, if I say this, if I do that? And, you know, that, I think, is a huge weight on a lot of people's shoulders.
I have, you know, one of the things that I talk about, especially when I speak to the Western audiences, is the segment called The Costs of Letting Go. And you know, one of the things when you're talking about Irtaza wanting to still have some sort of bond with his family, that represents to me another thing as well, is that, you know, for many of us, you know, we love our families. We grew up, you know, we obviously love our parents. We love our siblings. And I think a lot of times the dialogue, especially, you know, online and social media, is like, you know, if this ideology doesn't make sense, why don't you just leave it? Why don't you just change your mind? It's the rational approach. But human beings, is a lot more to human beings as well. So there is a cost when you're asking somebody to change their mind, you know, even if they find it irrational, you're also asking them to, in many cases, give up their family, give up their community, give up their knowing that their childhood friends who they care about will leave them, just dissociate from all of the memories they had growing up. You know, apart from the very physical threat, there's also that, and that's a big cost for just changing your mind. And I don't know
if that's the case, though, Ali, because I don't think that if you're convinced by something, no amount of emotion can. You're a slave to your logic. You
know? Oh no, I'm talking about people who already have thought about this, but they are afraid to speak out. They're afraid to come out and say it, not only because of the physical threat they have, but also because, you know, it's everything that they know. A lot of their sort of their grounding, their social grounding, gets lost. So I mean, it's similar to what Mariam is talking about.
Do you hear from people like that, Mariam? And also, how much do you have access to people from actually Islamic countries, opposed to ex-Muslims living in UK or other Western countries?
Yeah, I mean, I think, there's a lot of experience of that. And also, I think one of the things, this idea of shunning, you know, it just seems, oh, well, you're just shunned, you know, nobody wants to talk to you anymore. You don't have any friends anymore. We'll just go out and make new ones. But it does, you know, there's this psychologist who works with us and with women who are facing honor-related violence. And she says shunning is a form of psychological torture, especially if it carries on for a long-term period. And I think people don't recognize this, you know, and how it affects people and this need to belong. And, you know, we don't have churches or mosques where people can just show up. And so, you know, when you leave your family and your friends, you sometimes leave everything you've ever known, you know, and particularly when you think about the risks involved, that means you have to leave your university if you're studying. It means you have to leave the city you know and go somewhere where you might not be found, constantly looking over your shoulder. There's all of these things that make it so difficult. I mean, we've worked with people who've gone back to their families, you know, just because they cannot take that pressure and that feeling of aloneness. And no matter how much support, you know, we have support groups, we have meetups, we do one-on-one help, we refer people to refuges, all of this stuff. We have coming out parties, we have social events, but still, you know, there is this huge feeling of loneliness. And so that is something that, you know, does affect a lot of people. And of course, you know, we deal with, it's interesting because we were just looking at how many people we work with every month. And I was giving out the statistics of around 300 and something people a month. But we've actually started counting it now. And it's actually over 800 people a month coming to us for some sort of assistance. So whether it's, of course, here, a lot of people who are applying for asylum or people who are trying to get safety from their families. Those are the main groups of people who work with here.
800 people a month have approached the Council of Ex-Muslims of Britain for
assistance. These are ex-Muslims in UK?
It's in UK, it's in Europe and the West, and also, of course, in countries under Islamic rule. So, and these are people who actually, it's not just people who've gone on our forum. You know, we've got a forum with, you know, 7,000 members with, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of posts and so on, or people who, you know, come to our events. It's people who actually have asked for some sort of support and where we've tried to help in whatever way we can. So, and again, this is the tip of the iceberg, isn't it? Because there's just so many more people out there that aren't able to reach out or,
Yeah, I mean, all the psychological problems that you're mentioning is mostly about ex-Muslims in UK or in Canada or in the US or in Australia. But then the problems are 10 times more, or a lot more, if you're talking about ex-Muslims in Iran, Saudi Arabia, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Indonesia. I can't imagine like what they are. I mean, I know in Iran, a lot of people in Iran at least think that they live in upper Tehran, and they think that that's the whole country, and as everywhere is as lovely as upper Tehran. But I know most of the country is not that, in Pakistan, for example, it's not even the government that you have to be worried about. It's the people, it's the mobs that are coming after you. In Iran, it's the government. In Saudi Arabia, it's the government. In Bangladesh, it's the mob, it's the people. But the security, a lot of people just tell them, like, why do you even have to be an ex-Muslim? Just fake it until you make it. Like, just who cares what your views are? What would you say to those people? Like, they think it's a minor issue. Like, just don't talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, just to add something about people who live in the West as well, and psychological effects are hugely important as well. And of course, people who live in countries under Islamic rule face those psychological traumas and effects too. Physically too, there's a lot of people here who self-harm, who are, you know, we've got members who've been burned, who've been cut, who've been beaten, who've been taken for exorcism. Because they're ex-Muslims and atheists. And of course, that's the same in countries under Islamic rule. And plus, there's the death penalty as well, and mob violence, as you mentioned, you know. So right. There is this huge, and obviously it's much riskier there. Right. What I would say, well, again, I think people have to, I would never tell someone that they need to say that they're ex-Muslim. I think this is a choice we all have to make for ourselves, because people have to take in a consideration, safety, how safe it is for them, what the real risks are that are involved. But if someone decides that they want to say it, I think they have a right to. And, you know, in the way that when people were told, well, don't say you're gay and just carry on and it'll be fine. They won't
don't ask, don't tell.
Against you. Yeah. You know, the point is that why should people not say who they are and what they think? And they have a fundamental right to do that. And if we have to remain silent because of the violence that people face, well, you need to target those who are violent rather than those who are merely expressing who they are and what they think. And I think we need to, and we've done that, I think, all of us, by the very fact of coming out, of speaking out over this past, you know, a decade and more, we have opened the space up for many more people to do that. And that's exactly what will help a lot more people, because there is safety in numbers, isn't there? Right. Everybody can't be killed. Everybody can't be arrested.
I think a lot of people that say that don't know how suffocating it is to be an ex-Muslim living under an Islamic government or in a Muslim community. They don't get it how it feels to just go in and pretend and not be who you are and not have to behave in certain ways. And, sometimes some people just think it's worth the risk. You know, it's just they're so freaking tired of it. They just want to, I mean, even if you think it's stupid, I don't think we get to make that decision. If some people think the risk is worth it, they're adults, they're making that decisions for themselves, right?
Yeah, and I mean, part of it is too that, look, if you cannot say what you think and live the way you want, you're not really living, are you? You're a prisoner, you're slowly dying, you know? And so it's interesting because we interviewed a lot of ex-Muslim women. And we're trying to finish this film that we made. But basically, all of them have faced so much trauma and violence and risks and so on and so forth. Asked all of them, was it worth it? And they all, without a doubt, even though they went through the most horrible traumas, they will all say, it's worth it.
Wow.
It's worth it because, you know, it's like ask an atheist here in the US, for example, or in Britain, why don't you walk around in a hijab because your parents want you to, and go to a mosque and pray, or get up at dawn and pray five times a day or three times a day or whatever, and stop eating things that you don't want to, and you're not allowed to meet with the opposite sex just because your parents will. Well, they say, well, I'll do it quietly. There's only so much you can do quietly. And you can see that, for example, in a country like Iran, a lot of people do a lot of things quietly, but it comes out because people cannot stop being who they are. And you know, they have a right to do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So moving on to you mentioned meetups and people coming together and how this is helping people realize that they're not alone. You organized last year the largest, pretty much the largest gathering of ex-Muslims in history in London. Then this conference was hugely successful. It introduced us to sort of many free thinkers that I didn't previously know about, like Muhammad Al-Khadra from Jordan and a variety of others. Armin was there. I really wanted to be there, but I couldn't. That wasn't, so what I wanted to talk about is that wasn't actually the only thing last year. Was by far one of the most prominent, but there's a group called Muslimish here that brings together ex-Muslims and questioning Muslims. And we've had Ibrahim Abdullah and Nuran Babi here and on the podcast as well, who've talked about it. They organized two conferences last year. In addition to that, ex-Muslims of North America is now doing a tour, a college tour, where they're going to, and you've participated in some of those events, where they're going to prominent universities in the United States and actually really just coming out there and having people ask questions. And, you know, not to downplay the risk. I mean, this is a huge risk. So I know that security precautions have to be taken at all of these events, and the threat is very real, especially for people, you know, ex-Muslims living overseas. But this feels to me like a huge step forward. It feels like tremendous progress, considering that, you know, the Salman Rushdie affair was just less than 30 years ago. And it just kind of shows to me that the internet and people coming together online and being able to communicate even anonymously at first and then coming out of the closet has just had a tremendous impact. And to me, it feels like night and day where we are now.
Yeah. Even compared to 5 years ago, it's
right. I mean, look at this. We had the podcast. We have Armin, your book. We have my book. I mean, these are out. We're openly touring for these books. There's a lot of interest in them. There are ex-Muslims who are reaching out to us from around the world. So one of the things that we wanted to do with this podcast this year, especially is with the Muslim Enlightenment theme, is sort of strike a note of optimism where, you know, we're not just talking acknowledging
you our past. I'll bring the pessimism right after
it. Yeah, so we'd play good cop, bad cop here. But there's of course, we acknowledge the past and all of these stories and everything we've been talking about and how difficult it is. We never want to forget that. But at the same time, I think there is I'll call it cautious optimism, in a way. There's a cautious optimism, just seeing everything that's happening. And I was wondering what your take is on that, having been involved in this since with CEMB for, you know, since 2007 now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we should be optimistic because I think whatever the problems in the world, you know, there's so much tragedies and calamities and violations. On the other hand, there's also a lot of resistance and dissent. And I think we do a disservice to those people who are resisting if we only recognize the bad things that are going on. I think, and that's what the ex-Muslim movement for me represents, is that resistance and that hope. It's not the only form of resistance, but it's one very important one, particularly because it is punishable by death. And it is a dissent and resistance that's being recognized by those in power. You know, everything from Saudi Arabia saying that atheism is equated to terrorism. You've got the Egyptian government trying to criminalize atheism. They've set up two ministries to talk about how to deal with atheism. You've got, an Iranian state media publication talking about the tsunami of atheism in Iran. I started using that word of tsunami. Yeah. So it's clear
in Malaysia, they said they're going to hunt down atheists in Malaysia. Yeah. That's where the government.
So a lot of this, Mariam, the tsunami of atheism, that's another thing that I've kind of quoted you on. And much of this I see, I mean, of course, it's horrible when Saudi Arabia says that, you know, atheism is a terrorist offense and all of these new developments that you just mentioned. There's another spin on it. I mean, that doesn't change the gravity of it, but the spin on it is a lot of this stuff is reactive. As you said,
that's exactly the point I was making, is that exactly that even they recognize that this is something that they're worried about. Right. And it is something that is positive. That's exactly the point I was trying to make. Yeah. Not to say how awful it is, but even they recognize that we are a threat to their order of things. Mm-hmm. And I think that is so hopeful and encouraging. And so I think it's important always to see resistance, always recognize, you know, what we're faced with. It's a very brutal, savage movement, really, that not just the Islamic right, but the religious right in general. And in, you know, challenging that, one big section of that are the ex-Muslims. And I think it's important to recognize that. And it's, I think it's very hopeful. It is something that, and we're seeing huge amounts of change in such a short period of time. And again, I think that's thanks to the internet. You know, before the internet, this would have taken forever. And we might not even have been here. But now, because of it, things are moving, you know, at such a quick pace that...
Oh, did we lose Mariam?
No.
So imagine a little further down.
Mm-hmm. Is it one thing, you know, you're Iranian, Armin here is Iranian as well. There was a recent poll, I think it showed, I don't know if it was Western countries or the US, I'll confirm, but it showed that of people who were born Muslim, 23% have left, right? And I think this was for the US. Okay, yeah, so this was a U.S. poll that showed 23% of Muslims have left the U.S. And a large proportion of them were actually Iranian. So is there a is Iran sort of leading the way, or are there other factors here that are in play where there's an ex-Muslim movement is so prominent among the Iranian community?
Yeah, I think Iranians are very key in this movement. And it's not just because I'm Iranian, but because I think of the real social and political factors around it. I mean, I think if you look at all the initial ex-Muslim organizations, they were all begun by Iranians. And that has to do with the fact that, you know, there was a revolution in Iran today because Victor's right history is labeled an Islamic revolution. It wasn't an Islamic revolution. It was a left-leaning revolution. And, you know, this anti-religion sort of component has been very strong in Iran, not just since the establishment of an Islamic Republic in Iran, but even prior to that, this anti-religion sort of intellectuals and political and social movements. So I think, you know, the effects of that is something we feel today very strongly. And you're seeing that also in ongoing protests in Iran, for example, the women's movement against the veil.
The My Stealthy Freedom, the movement.
Yeah, exactly. So I think this is something that is very much part of that. But again, it's also the reality that a lot of population in the Middle East and North Africa, South Asia, they're young, and there is this natural sort of resistance to religious rules because it affects every aspect of your life in a way that makes it difficult to even go to listen to certain music or dress the way you want or have sex with who you want. And so because of that, there is this constant battle and challenge taking place. And part of that is challenging religious norms then.
And how much of this...
Can I ask about one thing regarding the Iranian anti-Islam? I mean, what I noticed among a lot of Iranians is that the anti-Islam movement in Iran is very, very passionate and is filled with anger because of the amount of influence Islam has had in their lives. But sometimes I notice that, I mean, not sometimes, a lot of times, I notice that there's a lot of racism and anti-Arab messages that comes with that anti-Islamism. They see this Islam as this Arab foreign invasion of their country. And everything Islamic is also, they consider it Arabic. They consider, I noticed like many anti-Islam Iranians, some of them are atheists. Some of them actually go to Zoroastrianism because they think that's the Iran's religion. But even among atheists, I noticed there's a, not all of them, of course, again, not hashtag, not all, but there is among many of them. Are you worried that a lot of the anti-Islam movement from Iran that you're seeing is also seems to be a bit racist and anti-Arab?
Well, I mean, I think we see racism among atheists of all nationalities. That's the reality, including, you know, US and British atheists and that sort of that anti-Muslim, for example, bigotry that we see in some sections. And I think we need to make a distinction between being opposed to Arab imperialism in places like Iran, for example, versus anti-Arab sentiment. And I think that's a real sentiment. There's a lot of racism in all societies, including Iranian society, against Arabs, against Afghans, for example. You know, it's a huge issue. And I think it's important, that's why, when we have these debates, to make these distinctions about, and we do that all the time. I think you both do that too, is the distinction between criticizing a religion, criticizing people, you know, and criticizing a religious right movement and so on and so forth. So I think, you know, part and parcel of the world we live in, a world that puts profit first and human welfare last, and how this sort of world needs racism and sexism and homophobia and all of that identity politics in order to carry on with business as usual. And so you find lots of movements having these issues to grapple with. And it's something that we need to face head on. So I think, but apart from that, I think the anti-Islamic backlash in Iran is something that is very much because of the lived experience of living in an Islamic state. You didn't have this sort of backlash prior to the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And I think that's what's important to recognize here, that this is a lived experience, but also, you know, you have that lived experience in many places. Why is this Russian? You know, we talk about how they are still the effects of the Bolshevik Revolution, for example, when it comes to International Women's Day, the effects of the French Revolution with the concept of fraternity, equality, and liberty. In the same way, I think, when you look at the Iranian Revolution and its effects, the very recent revolution in comparison to the other ones, you know, that anti-Islamic strain is very much present, and you see it in many of the progressive social and political movements that are taking place in Iran that in the Middle East and North Africa, for example, in Europe or Afghanistan as well. And you see that, and there's an anti-racist component to that too. So it depends, you know, I think nothing is homogeneous, not ex-Muslims and not Muslims.
I think one good solution to that would be to introduce, like, the fact that this ex-Muslim movement is a global movement, introducing a lot of Iranian atheist ex-Muslims to Arab atheist ex-Muslims would be a good way to, you know, show them that this is an ideological battle. It has nothing to do with Persian versus Arab.
Yeah, I've actually seen that even in these groups, like the members of CEMB, members of XMNA, members of Muslimish. I've seen people who are Iranian ex-Muslims who interact with Arab ex-Muslims, and there is a sort of a realization that it isn't. I mean, they have their friendly rivalry, like the U.S. and Canada, for instance, but it doesn't. When they do see each other, it does humanize them, and it kind of brings them together on a bond of values, of common values.
And sometimes it doesn't work as well. I remember I had an Iranian friend. Yeah. I told him, he said, like, oh, I like that Arab guy so much. I like him so much that I don't even consider him an Arab. That's how much.
I don't know. I just different. Find that sort of thing so, I don't know, really disgusting, to be honest. Like, idea that we have to, you know, we don't like X because they're Iraqi, for example, or Y because they're this, or Muslim, or whatever category of people. And I think it's just, it's such a bad way of looking at things, because, you know, we are human beings after all, and the sooner we realize that we're all human and that we all have much more in common than what separates us, the better our world is going to be, you know. And I think that's why, for me personally, you know, fighting for the rights of ex-Muslims, for the right to apostasy and blasphemy, it's been intrinsically linked with the fight against the far right, against racism, because I think that, you know, we have to fight on any movement that dehumanizes, any ideology.
That's or tribal. It's from,
that divides people, that dehumanizes people, and that makes it acceptable to attack a group just because they belong to a different group from yours.
So,
or do you think your group is superior? You know, that all has the same sort of connotations.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to sort of go on to, you know, you talk about my stealthy freedom. So there is a sort of conflict going on. We had Nick Cohen on recently on the podcast, and you know him. He had you on his documentary, The Silence of the Liberals, and he made a point about we have this issue with women who are ripping off their hijabs in Iran, right? They're taking it off, and then on the in the United States with the Women's March, there are feminists who are putting on the hijab as a symbol of solidarity with Muslims who are victims of or who are targets of anti-Muslim bigotry, you know, the Trump era and the alt-right and the far right. So as someone who, I mean, I know you lean left, I myself lean left as well. So how do you reconcile this? Like this idea that over there, we're fighting for the right for women to take off their hijab. And over here, there's a movement to try and show solidarity with people who are choosing to wear it. And it's almost become a symbol of feminism. One other thing I wanted to add to this is what Nick Cohen said about it was that he said that there's a difference between defending the right of people to choose to wear the hijab versus celebrating or endorsing the choice. So I just wanted to kind of get your take on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is that I think it's not necessarily over there and over here so much of a dichotomy. There are people who are fighting very hard to take the hijab off here as well, right, as they are in Iran, and there are people trying to impose the veil in Iran as they are here too. So it's actually a very global thing. It's something that women are struggling against. I think, for me personally, I think adult women have a right to wear the veil if they so choose. But again, I think that the veil is a tool to restrict women. I think it's like foot binding to me. It's like the chastity belt. It's like the practice of sati, where women might choose to put themselves on the burning pyre when their husbands are being set alight. And there's studies even to show how they've chosen to do that. I would say first choice is questionable when there's so much pressure involved. But let's say if someone truly, freely chooses to do so, I still don't think you should celebrate people taking on symbols that are oppressive towards women. I mean, if we look at fundamentally why women are supposed to be veiled and why girls from the age of 9 or even younger are supposed to be veiled, it's because there seem to be a source of chaos or fitna in society if women's bodies are seen. There'll be rape, there'll be adultery. I mean, I've had, Islamic scholars explain this, isn't it better that we tell people to veil, because otherwise we'll have to stone them to death because they'll commit adultery and we can't control anyone. And it's this idea that is behind the veil. And so to romanticize it, to sanitize it, is not something that's pro-women's rights or even minority rights or any form of rights.
Right.
At all, and also it disregards the fact that for every woman who chooses to wear that veil, let's say it's a white convert in Paris or in Britain, there are not two or three, but hundreds of thousands of them by brute force. And, just looking at the situation in Iran now, look at the violence against women who are removing their veils, and apart from that, remember the initial slogan at the when compulsory veiling came into force in Iran. There were hundreds of thousands who came out on the street to oppose compulsory veiling, including Asian men.
Yeah, those pictures
and there's video footage as well. And the slogans were, either you veil or you get punched. And actually, having women had their veils stuck on with pins, all of these sorts of things. They were beaten by chains in the streets. So it was imposed by force. And now you have feminists saying it's our culture, it's our religion. And you've seen that across the globe. I mean, when did women in Afghanistan dress in a burqa 40 years ago? So it's again, what's been imposed, what's part of an Islamist project has now been celebrated as women's choice. And again, the misogyny of that and the acceptance of that misogyny as something that's liberating is astonishing when you really think about what it represents.
My wife, Alishba, you know, she has she's made an analogy between the hijab and the Confederate flag. She said, you know, people in the southern United States, they have the right to fly the Confederate flag and put it on their trucks, but, you know, they shouldn't forget what the history of that symbol was and what it represents. I think that's what you're saying.
And tell me if the way I look at hijab, and you could tell me if this is correct or not. I think basically it's a sign of this is my property. Right. Basically, the way that it's not a statement that is woman is making. It's a statement that the man is making that, hey, this is my property. I'm protecting my property against other men that might want to take away my property.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, because the whole idea is that you have to be veiled again in front of anyone who's non-mahram, who's not religiously prescribed to you. So, you know, it's the people like your father, your husband. Those are the people who are allowed to see you because they own you, basically. And so there is that sort of ownership involved. And also when you look at, I mean, the issue of hijab for young kids, I mean, one of the things I say is, okay, if you're an adult, even if I think your choice is not real, even if I think there's pressure involved, even if I think it's a symbol of misogyny, I would say you have a right to wear it. When it comes to children, I think it is child abuse. I think it is a form of sexualizing children, abusing children. I think it should be just as awful if, you know, a girl is mutilated. Right. And there are people who will actually defend. I mean, I remember in the 80s being told off by feminists for calling it FGM. They were saying it's cutting, circumcision, it's like having your ears pierced, it's a cultural thing, how dare you call it mutilation. And so in the same way you have people explaining and justifying the veil, the child veiling, to me I think they're just different forms of the same thing, controlling women's sexuality, controlling their bodies, erasing women from the public space, silencing them and moving all agency. So to call it empowering or something that's liberating is, you know, just
I've had several hijabi feminists come to me and say, well, why are you talking about the hijab? You're a man. You shouldn't be telling Muslim women what to wear. And my response is always, I'm like, the whole hijab was mansplaining. I mean, this was basically, there was a male prophet. If you're Shia, there are four male, 12 male imams. If you're Sunni, there's four male caliphs. And these are the people who are all polygamous, all had child brides. These are the people who are telling. So you're saying that a 21st century man can't talk about this, but a 7th century men, you know, from the desert who prescribed this, you know, you'll take the mansplaining when it comes to that.
I mean, the hijab is more about men than it is about women.
It is. It's a male prescribed thing.
I mean, if the purpose of hijab is to make men not attracted to women, for me that backfired, because if you keep growing around hijabi girls and hijabi school outfit, you grow to learn that this certain outfit, this is you associate that with the female body. So now, in a weird sense, some types of hijab are attractive to me. So now it's completely backfired. This is not it's not doing its job. It's not doing what it's meant to do.
You're sick.
Yeah, what can you do? Like you grow around and you see schoolgirls always in their hijab. So that's what you see. This is how girls look like. So what are you going to think when you see a hijab girl?
Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
No. Please go ahead. Go ahead.
And also this whole idea that it's to protect women. You know, it's such a patronizing sort of, you know, it's always, whenever they create rules to restrict women, it's always promoted as it's there to protect you. So, you know, women in Iran aren't allowed to enter stadiums because, God forbid, they listen to men cursing or they see the men's thighs playing football and they're just not going to be able to, you know, handle it. This all comes from this position of protection. And again, you know, with girls and women, it's about protecting them. But which countries have the highest level of sexual violence and assault and groping, in the streets, 90 something percent in Egypt, in Iran. I mean, I don't think I know anybody who hasn't been groped.
Pakistan too.
I'm just saying, in the streets, it's just, and in fact, you see a correlation between the more restrictions there are on women, the more unsafe it is for women, because it gives this impression that women are subhuman, second-class citizens. They are the property of men. So I remember, for example, I lived in Sudan for 2 years where I was working with Ethiopian refugees, and I was riding a motorcycle and I fell, and I had all these men rushing towards me, and I thought, oh, how lovely, they've come to help me. They were shouting at me, why are you, why are you driving a motorcycle? It's so bihaya, you've got no shame, you've got this, you've got nothing. And it's this thing that, if they saw a man fall down, they would run and help him. So the fact that you're a woman, because you've got these restrictions, it makes you, you're not human anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not just the property of your husband and your father, it's by extension, everybody feels they have a right to tell you what to do, how to dress. And that's why you see in Iran, for example, there are people, passers-by, saying your hijab is not on properly. Who the hell are you in the first place? But
I'm Rabbi Ma'aruf and I has Munkar. They think they have the right to because of that doctrine.
So let's, I guess this is sort of tangentially connected, but we have a question from one of our patrons.
Before we go to patron question, I just wanted to ask one last question from our side, and then we'll go to patron question. Mm-hmm. I'm always afraid to, start competing in the oppression Olympics where people say that we're the most victimized. But if ex-Muslims, not ex-Muslims in Canada or US, but ex-Muslims in Bangladesh, Saudi Arabia, Iran, don't you think if they're not the most victimized, they're one of the most victimized? I mean, it's hard for me to imagine, maybe Yazidis have it worse, but it's hard for me to imagine a group of people that are like you, there's death penalty for them in 13 countries. And in other countries that there is no death penalty for them, so many of them, they have prison sentences for them.
Or they're thrown to the mob. Yeah.
Or they're thrown to the mob. Yeah. I mean, Christians don't have it. Christians in Egypt don't have it this bad. Jews in Iran don't have it this bad. Like, Jews in Iran and Saudi Arabia have it better than ex-Muslims. Ex-Muslims in Malaysia, when the minister came and said, we need to hunt down atheists. And nothing, this guy still has his job. This is not, Malaysia is not Iran, is not Saudi Arabia, it's not Bangladesh. This is supposed to be the most moderate, advanced Islamic country that is out there. This is the best we can hope for in an Islamic country. And this guy doesn't even lose his job. It's not even a controversy in his country. Well, there is some outside of his country, but not that much. Like, he still holds a position. I would say, like, if in Iran, even if there is discrimination against Jews, there is not too much to the point where the government would ever say, we are going to hunt down the Jews. The Iranian government claims that the Jews have it good in Iran. Even if there is discrimination against Jews or Christians in Saudi Arabia, you will never hear the government saying, if they came out and say, we need to hunt down Christians and Jews in Saudi Arabia, this would be an international outcry. But ex-Muslims are fair game, not only in Saudi Arabia and Iran, but even in Malaysia. And if government officials said that about any other minority group, about black people, about Jews, about Christians, about any other minority group anywhere in the world, this would be international headline. But ex-Muslims is nothing. We don't hear anything. Maybe a little bit of news, but not much.
I mean, I think there's a couple of things here. One is that I think when you live in a society where you can be killed for what you think, lots of people can get killed for what you think. If you can get killed for who you love, lots of people can get killed for who they love or discriminated against. I think it's hard to gauge, and I don't want to even go about who has it worse or better, because I think it's not really relevant. Even if one person's rights are violated, it's something that we need to be concerned about. And I think for a better way of looking at it is to see how these violations are linked. For example, In countries where ex-Muslims or atheists are can be killed, so can LGBT. So can people who, for example, fall in love with the wrong type of person, whether it's by the state or by mob violence.
Or blasphemy.
Blasphemy, exactly. Yeah. So there's also, and even religious minorities like Baha'is in Iran, for example, long-term prison sentences they get, executions and so on and so forth. What I think is different with ex-Muslims, and where I understand what you're saying, but I think it's because religion is so privileged in the world that we live in, and the Jewish and Christian faiths are considered faiths of the book by many Islamic states. And so whilst there is huge amounts of discrimination, you know, because religion is privileged and because we're seen to be criticizing religion and also criticizing what's considered a minority religion in the West, that for that reason, it seemed to be a no-go area. So rather than defending victims, we're blamed for the violence that we face.
Okay, but here's the thing, though. And the reason I will say why I think it is important is, I mean, Baha'i is discriminated against Iran, but you can be openly Baha'i and nobody's going to kill you for it, right? But you're still discriminated against. You could be openly Zoroastrian, you could be openly Hindu. But if you're openly ex-Muslim, even if you don't criticize Islam, you're basically asking for a death sentence. You're not asking for discrimination, you're asking for death sentence. And the reason why I think, the reason I'm not trying to say we have it worse, oh, please pay attention to us and not to attention to, what I'm suggesting is that I'm not trying to take away from Christians that are discriminated against, for example, in Egypt or in Iran. What I'm asking for is the same level of outcry, right? That we hear, that we just say this, I mean, Christians that are being discriminated against in Egypt, they deserve all the attention they get. What I'm saying is that we're not getting as much, the ex-Muslims are not getting as much attention as they deserve.
Yeah,
I think the ex-Muslim movement is the civil rights movement of our time. This needs to become a highlight. This needs to be what the gay rights movement was in the West. This needs to be the next big movement of our time. And that's why I think, I'm not trying to steal from anyone else. I just think that we don't.
No, you're completely right. Look, you're completely right. I think we shouldn't compare oppressions, because you're always going to find people who are worse off, you know. And I think there's a problem when you're dealing with human rights to compare and say, well, look, women in Iran can drive, so women in Saudi Arabia are worse off. Because it's a way of actually then saying, well, we don't need to do anything about it because they're better off. Do you know what I mean? And I'm not saying you're saying that, but generally this is what is often done in order to avoid responsibility and solidarity with people who are facing oppression. What I think we need to do is to make very clear that this is a movement that needs to be supported, and to start further challenging people who blame victims rather than blaming the perpetrators. So, you know, Charlie Hebdo, well, if they hadn't drawn the cartoon, you know, you're ex-Muslim and you're facing the death penalty, well, maybe if you hadn't offended so many people, you wouldn't be on death row. And the point is that, you know, this is what makes it easier for people to ignore what's happening to ex-Muslims, because there's always an excuse of why you're getting the punishment because somehow you're to blame for it, you know. And I think that's where we have the greatest challenge, in a way that other groups that are facing the death penalty and all don't have that sort of problem. And again, it's because, you know, of de facto blasphemy laws as well in countries where there are no blasphemy laws, but it's still being pushed forward in that way. So I think that's something that is affecting it, and that's why we have the situation that we have.
All right, okay, so let's. I wanted to get some of the patron questions in, so we'll just do that, Armin, because just in the interest of time. So one of the first ones I wanted to ask is, this is from Sohan D'Souza, and this is relating to a recent event. So he says, "What does Maryam think of France's denial of citizenship to the Algerian woman who refused to shake hands, and laïcité, and the Swiss minaret band?" And I guess this is a sort of larger question about some of these measures that are being taken. I mean, mostly in European countries, against things like, you know, the candidate. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, for example, I'm opposed to the minaret ban. I think if you can have church steeples, then you should be able to have a minaret. I think more of a concern should be if there are mosques that are centers of Islamism that are funded by Islamic states, that's something that we should be more focused on rather than if there's a minaret here or a steeple there. On the handshake, I mean, I think it goes back to this idea of French secularism and making sure that things related to the state are devoid of of any sort of religious belief. So it's not that women are not allowed any longer to shake hands with men, or they have to shake hands with men on the street or elsewhere, but it's when it comes to a sort of secular ceremony. So it's the same idea where you can't wear a veil and be a judge, for example, you know, the banning of conspicuous religious symbols in schools, for example. You can't be a teacher because, or wear the cross or the kippah, because these are all ways of, even if it's subtly proselytizing in a setting that has to be completely secular, the state has to be ignorant in a way of a religion. So I think that's where this handshake ban is coming from.
Mm-hmm. But when I was in, just a quick follow-up on this, when I was in Brussels last week, the big news at the over there was that there was a political candidate who was an Orthodox Jewish, and he had said that he wouldn't be shaking hands with women. So what they did was they, eventually there was a huge outcry, and they had him resign from the candidacy because he said he wouldn't shake hands with women. Does France also apply this to, say, or ultra-Orthodox Jewish people who refuse to sit next to women on planes or who wouldn't shake hands with women as well? Do you know? Or
I mean, one of the things, too, is that a lot of secularists in France have argued, including many secularists from Muslim backgrounds who are atheists or secularists, they said that there was never even a need for the sort of banning of conspicuous religious symbols and so on and so forth, because those laws already exist in France, because since the early 1900s, the law with the separation of the church from the state already didn't allow for any religious symbols in areas which were state sponsored or run by the state, like the courts, like the schools. And so it does apply, in fact, and that's what a lot of secularists are saying, that this is not a hijab ban, it's a ban on religious symbols. And I think that's something that's very often lost. So it includes the Jewish kippah, it includes the crucifix, it includes, you know, the hijab.
Right. Okay, another question, and this is about, I guess, a situation in the UK, and this is a concern that a lot of our patrons have had. So this is from Claudia, saying, I keep reading stories about England that are alarming, the influence of Sharia courts where women don't have the same rights they would under British law, the widespread grooming and rape gang scandals, no prosecutions for FGM, even though it is happening and is illegal. How much is the influence of Islam eroding secular and liberal values? And also about England, it seems like it is becoming very difficult to criticize Islam with people being fired or even prosecuted for doing so. What are your observations and thoughts about how much this is or isn't a problem?
I mean, I think obviously it's a problem because I also campaign against Sharia courts. I campaign,
right.
You know, on the apostasy and blasphemy laws.
So one law for all, right? You had that organization.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. I'm one of the people who is sometimes banned or barred from speaking at universities, for example, because I'm, accused of inciting hatred when really I'm just criticizing Islam and Islamism. So I think, of course, it is a problem. I think partly it's a very big problem in Britain because Britain is not itself a secular society. So, for example, you know, there are prayers in Parliament. I think people would be surprised to learn, possibly. There are bishops in the House of Lords, so it's sometimes it looks like the Islamic regime's majlis, you know, the Islamic assembly. Of course, you know, the Queen is the head of the Church of England as well. And so, therefore, the British state has a stake in continuing this role, religion's role in the state. And therefore, that's why we see a very wishy-washy sort of secularism. You know, the society in Britain is very secularized, but what we see from many state institutions is not the separation of religion from the state, because it's not separate in Britain when it comes to the Anglican Church, but the sort of equality for all religions. And so that's why, you know, there's an encouragement of Islamic schools, for example, of Sharia courts. You know, there's been inquiries in Parliament. I spoke at it. There have been investigations, but all of them have been sort of quietly either whitewashed or put aside, because it does fundamentally deal with this question of how much of a role should religion play in British society. And I think there's very little problem that the state has with it. And that's why it's a problem throughout.
That's so scary.
So one other thing that I got from that we got from a lot of patrons is about your appearance on the Sam Harris podcast. We wanted to, I guess this goes against the whole thing that, you know, the accusations of bigotry, and obviously there are a lot of people in the ex-Muslim community who have been supported a lot by Sam Harris, and they also admire you a lot. So do you have any reflections on that in general?
Oh, well, I wish I had never done it, that's for sure. I mean, the thing is, look, from my perspective, you know, I'm going to say something maybe that's not going to be very liked. But I think when it comes to the issue of bigotry, I do agree that that term is bandied around a lot, yeah? I'm also accused of bigotry. I'm accused of Islamophobia. So I understand that there are many people who criticize Islam and Islamism that are not like Muslims who are accused of bigotry. But the reality is that there is a lot of bigotry as well. And very often the arguments against Sharia or against, the situation of women in countries under Islamic rule, this concern for them, is coming from a perspective, not because there's any real concern for women, for example, or real concern for people's rights, but because it's a way of talking about getting rid of all Muslims from Britain and, you know, attacking Muslim immigrants and refugees and homogenizing groups of people. So I think that really, that exists. Now, a lot of people will say, well, you know, we shouldn't use the term bigotry at all. About Sam Harris was that I didn't say he was a bigot. I said that his arguments feed into the far right narrative in the same way that these leftists who say that the veil needs to be defended are feeding into an Islamist narrative, because that narrative is one that says that you cannot question the veil, you cannot question Sharia laws, otherwise it's equivalent to bigotry. So I think for me, that's important. The very same people who say we shouldn't use the word bigotry at all are constantly using the term regressive left. So it's okay to criticize the left. It seems never okay to criticize the right or racism. I think it's important to do both.
Sorry. Are people like Sam Harris saying not to use the word bigotry at all, or are they saying not to use them on them? Because there are bigots.
I never call Sam Harris a bigot, but I did say that what he was saying, the whole thing, I've transcribed the entire discussion because there's so much hearsay and it's word for word, it's been transcribed.
Right.
I just said that that sort of narrative feeds into the far right narrative. The thing is that you and I both, we all know that against Islam, against Sharia law, is used the far right. We know that it's used to attack Muslims. It's used to demand an end to immigration from countries under Islamic rule. And we know very well that just as Muslims are not homogenous, there are many people who are on our side. Also, ex-Muslims are not homogenous. You know, people have their own politics, their own choices. And I think when we generalize about, you know, like Muslim immigration, this is the context I was talking to Sam Harris about, that we homogenize groups of people and we don't recognize that there's so much dissent and so much resistance taking place. And that many of those Muslims, including conservative Muslims, could be our allies. A great example is, you know, this unveiling movement in Iran. You've got women in chadors who think it's their right to wear a chador, saying that they support those who don't want to wear it. And you know, for me, Sharia courts, the veil, the gender segregation at universities, this de facto blasphemy laws, these are part of an Islamist project. And I think the attack on Muslim migration and refugees is part of the far-right project as well. And I think we need to be careful not to feed into any of these narratives. Lots of people are comfortable criticizing the so-called regressive left. They're less comfortable when you start criticizing the far-right. And I would challenge them to think about, you know, their own biases when it comes to that.
So one sort of follow-up to this is that, you know, you're talking about how this narrative can feed into the narrative of the far right. So, I mean, that's something that I've experienced as well. So I think in 2014, Breitbart wrote this like really glowing article about me, and I wanted no part in it. So, I mean, that kind of thing, I think it does happen to all of us, but how do you think of this as general? To what extent is, should I curtail what I'm saying, for instance, or to what extent should we hold back on what we're saying, or not hold back, but sort of modify what we're saying so it doesn't get used by them? Or is that even possible? Because in my experience, it's very, very hard to do this work or even criticize Islam or talk about ex-Muslims without somebody from the far right just taking it and using it the way they want.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, that's something that really always bothers me. You know, where we at Pride, we had Allies Gay Placard, and now you've got these far riders using that slogan and going into Muslim areas and handing out leaflets. And constantly I see them co-opting our arguments and our language as a way of saying that, you know, they're not really promoting a racist sort of nationalist politics. But I think that, you know, there's no black and white answer here. I think we need to say what we have to say, because we need to also be true to ourselves, you know, and feel that we're pursuing the truth in the best way that we possibly can. So I don't think we should ever stop saying what we think. But on the other hand, we also have to recognize that we live in a world where there is huge amounts of bigotry and racism, as well as, you know, anti-ex-Muslim, for example, bigotry. There's also a whole lot of racism against our families as well, refugees and migrants. And within that context, I think it's also important to fight against that as well. I think we need to fight on many fronts. You know, we don't say, well, you know, I mean, just to give you an example, I'm against U.S. militarism. I don't say I'm not going to speak about it anymore because the Islamists always talk about imperialism as a way of bombing and killing people. But on the other hand, I think that I need to be clear when I talk about U.S. militarism to also speak out against Islamism. And when I speak about Islam, also to talk about how it's not bigotry to criticize Islam, but to recognize that this discussion is sometimes used to promote bigotry. I think it's important to have that sort of outlook on things.
Okay, but you know, an example I often give is that, you know, when the Nazis, when they were gassing the Jews and explaining that some races are inferior to other races, what the main argument that they had on their side was Darwinism and evolution and the survival of the fittest. And my question to people is that if they're afraid that their narrative is going to be used by racists, do you think that we should also stop teaching like Darwinism, evolution? Because historically that has also been used. I mean, the truth is the truth and it needs to be voiced. And you mentioned yourself that your arguments has been used by the far right and you're not going to stop saying those things because it's used by the far right, right? So if we recognize that some of these could be used by racist people, I think, you might say that we need to go and challenge them, and I think we should, but I'm hesitant to say that everybody should do that because some people have certain passions. I mean, if somebody wants to focus on Christianity because that's their passion and they want to criticize Christianity, they should be able to do that. If somebody wants to criticize on Hinduism, they should be able to do that. If somebody wants to do all religions, they should be able to do that. And if somebody has a lot of passion about talking about Islam because that's because what they know, or that's what they're passionate about, or because that's what they've been hurt by the most. And if they just focus on that, I don't think it would be fair for us to go ask them to, like, hey, make sure you also go attack white supremacists.
Of course. First of all, I can't ask anyone to do anything. I'm just speaking about what I feel comfortable doing. Do you know what I mean? For me, I think, yeah, let's say if you're an activist against Christianity, but there are Christians who are being murdered in Egypt. Well, I think, it's not a bad thing for you to also speak on their behalf and to defend them and to criticize and condemn the murder of people because of their beliefs. And I think for me, I'm not just an anti-Islam activist. I'm not just anti-Sharia. I'm also pro-human rights. I'm pro-women's rights. I'm pro-LGBT rights. I'm pro, citizenship rights. And so for me, I think it's important to look at it within this larger context, particularly given the fact that, you do have a far right. This is not, we're not having a sort of theoretical debate. We're talking about,
oh, we got cut.
Of course, Islamism is our far right. So if you're opposed to Islamists, then you naturally should be opposed to far right politics. Right. And you should be able to see the links and the fundamental connections between other far right movements in the same way that when you criticize Islam, you don't then go and defend Christianity. I know some people do, but if you're criticizing Islam because you think religion is regressive, well, then, you should be able to see that links. You might not necessarily spend your whole time criticizing Christianity. I don't. Mm. But to recognize that those links exist, to really be able to deal with something in a more comprehensive manner and to defend people's rights,
Yeah,
because right. I think one of the problems is that there are, ex-Muslims who are so anti-Islam, and then they end up being anti-Muslim. And there's a lot of, anti-Muslim feeling as well. And I don't want to be a part of that. And for me, therefore, I make the conscious decision that I'm fighting Islamism, but I'm also against all religious rights movement. I'm against Islam, but I'm also against all religions. But I will defend people regardless of their beliefs, whether I agree with them or not. And that's why I defend refugee rights and I will defend, minarets in Switzerland, for example.
But one last note before we go to the last patron question is a more fun one, so we let that for last. But before we go to that one, I do also want to point out that as ex-Muslims, we haven't given up on even the most fundamentalist or extreme Muslims, right? Because we think that anybody has a chance. People make mistakes. People are wrong. People are human, right? We are faulty creatures, right? People are not always logical. So even if somebody is an ISIS supporter or an Al-Qaeda member, we haven't even given up on those people, right? And to be fair to the people, to everybody, and I think that when we look at alt-right or racist people, we shouldn't give up on them either. And this is why sometimes I think, like, we shouldn't, if they are our audience, we shouldn't ignore them. Because when you say sometimes some of these people from the far right, they learn from us and they say, oh, okay, we're not against Muslims, we're against Islam. Some of that is fake, but some of that might be genuine learning. Sometimes when we go reach out to these far right people, I do think that some of them, a lot of them felt like this Islam is a threat. And the only, because ex-Muslims were silent for so long, the only outlet they got was these far right and white supremacist or racist movements. And then when they were introduced to these other people who are like, hey, this is not a problem with people. This is a problem with ideology. Some of them might genuinely think like, okay, this is a better alternative.
Can I just say, for example, when Council of Ex-Muslims started, the Daily Mail contacted us and said they wanted to do a two-page spread on us, and we refused. You know, I prefer no one to know that we exist than to start our movement in that way. And I think we have to make a distinction between people. Of course, people can change. Of course they can. We, the three of us sitting here, are proof of that, aren't we? And you can have ex-Nazis and ex-Islamists, which to me are our Nazis, right?
Exactly.
But there's a difference between recognizing the ability to change in individual human beings to judging and then ignoring the realities of political movements. And I think that's where there's a mistake here, because it's different saying there might be someone who is an EDL member who is questioning, and I know lots of ex-EDL members. But when we're talking about the EDL, it's a real political movement with a real political manifesto. And we need to be able to criticize it, to condemn it, to judge it. And of course, all the while, you know, recognizing that people are able to change,
but,
and Muslims too, Muslims and non.
But what I'm suggesting is that if you get an EDL audience, don't just throw it away. Go to them and tell them that we shouldn't be against Muslims. We should be against Islam. These are people, and as ex-Muslims, we have problems with Christianity as well. I mean, if we get an opportunity to speak a whole bunch of EDL members, we could steal their audience and get it to our camp and like give them a better way.
I don't agree necessarily there. I would never refuse to speak to, you know, on a panel discussion where I've even spoken with Islamists, for example, who are dead. But what I think it is to recognize that movement represents
people, of course,
who want you dead. And so there's, you can have a dialogue in that situation. And I think a lot of far-right groups also want us deported. They, you know, couldn't care less if we were all killed. And so I think in that sense, it's very different. We need to, I think one of the mistakes that a lot of atheists make is that they don't recognize, you know, when there's a criticism of the EDL or the far right, they don't recognize it as a real political movement in the same way that they would recognize why you need to challenge Islamists. Right. And I think, again, there is a sort of affinity with the far right to some extent, because Islamists are the only one who criticize U.S. militarism. That's not looking at the whole picture, and it's taking, you know, selected things and not seeing what the real mission and aims and the basis of these movements are. Right. And I think that's important for us to see.
Yeah, okay. We recognize that when we talk to when we reach out to a lot of Islamists, they want us beheaded, and when we reach out to Nazis, we will be on the same trains to gas chambers if they were in power as well. Yeah. We do recognize that, but we still don't want to ignore them. But go on, Ali.
Okay, so I'm going to, since we have just a few minutes left, Mariam, we thought we'd end on this. This is a question from Michael, who's one of our patrons.
Yes.
And his question
is... Thank you, patrons, by the way. You guys are making this happen. And Mariam, our patrons were very excited, a lot of them, that they for you to come on this show. So.
Yeah, I mean, you are a true hero and pioneer of the movement. I know that we're going to embarrass you a little bit here, but I mean, as far as I'm concerned, at least, and many other people. So, the question is from Michael. I've seen some videos of some guys interrupting your talks. Could you tell the funniest and the scariest of those events? And how safe do you feel on an everyday basis and during your talks and debates?
Well, this was more dark than lighthearted.
It is dark, but I mean, he did ask for the funniest. Yeah, okay. I don't know how funny it's going to be, but
what's the funniest thing that's happened to me?
Well, in terms of a talk, like, you know, sometimes you have protests and obviously they're all dangerous and they're sinister, but occasionally if you have a lighthearted moment that jumps out at you.
You turned off the lights, I knew, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, the funniest death threat I ever got was from the Iranian regime. I picked up and they were like, you're going to get killed. We're coming to get you. And it was a bloody recording. I mean, can you imagine how many people they had to threaten that day? And they're like, we don't even have enough BCGs to threaten. Let's just put on this recording and bask all the people. So I find that quite hilarious, you know. But to be honest, I think when we get the reaction that we get, I have this position, you know, people sometimes say, well, why aren't you more afraid? And I kind of feel like they're afraid of us. I don't need to get violent. I don't believe in violence. I don't need to like shut down someone's PowerPoint and, try and intimidate them, because I think that we're on the winning side. We're on the right side, and we just have to galvanize and mobilize support, get people to understand where we stand, where we're coming from. Sometimes, of course, break taboos, shock where we can, provoke. I think these are hugely important things that we have. Go against the mainstream and status quo. But nonetheless, I think they're actually afraid of us. Otherwise, they wouldn't need to bother with, you know, why would they care if we're coming and speaking on a university thing? Obviously, we have something that threatens them. And so in that sense, I do agree with you, Ali, about this being an enlightenment. I think we're very much part of that enlightenment. And I think ex-Muslims actually can lead that, because we are willing to question and criticize Islam in a way that many Muslims aren't even willing to do. Eat themselves reformers. I have a problem with reform. I don't think religion can reform. I think religion is regressive.
Just made Armin light up when you said
that. I think society reforms. Society reforms. Reform in what it actually means is changes in the law. And, you know, you cannot change religious law. What you can change is the way society looks at those texts, looks at those laws, and have laws that protect women, LGBT, minorities, atheists, so that religion cannot have the destructive effect that it has on people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I say is Muslims can reform, Islam can never be reformed.
That's
I agree. I think it's just so backward. Like all religions, it really belongs in the dustbins of history. Right.
And that's such a great ending line.
I was thinking that Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, they should have like this. You should get a call and they say, press 5 for your death threat. And then you press 5. And this is an official death threat from the Islamic
Republic. You have AI threatening you?
Please press 2 if you confirm that you've received this death threat. Press 1 if you want to repeat.
you know, Maryam, one of the reasons that we did another reason why we call this the Muslim Enlightenment is because we wanted to create that distinction with reform, because when you're talking to especially Western audiences and you say reform, there is an analog to the Reformation. When you say Enlightenment, there's an analog that they recognize, and I think that's a very important way to especially talk to many liberals, in the sense that, you know, we tell them, hey, and you're beneficiaries of this process when your people did it. Now when our people are doing it, you got to support us, because if you don't, then you're the bigot. Right.
And the values that the West enjoys today was a product of the Enlightenment movement, not the Reformation movement. The Enlightenment movement was a movement that challenged religion and put religion to the side, not the Reformation movement, which was a different kind of religion. It wasn't a change in religion. It was basically forcing religion to take a back seat.
Yeah, I mean, I've always said that a reformed religion, a so-called reformed religion, is the one that's handing out food at soup kitchens, you know, the world. It needs to do something nice to get people to come to church or whatever.
Not even that.
In that sense, I want a reformed religion out of, the public space, out of our lives. You want to believe in it, that's your right. But, you know, keep it off of our bodies, our lives, our, you know, the state, the schools. And of course, the laws.
Yeah. Right. Mariam, thank you so much for joining us. Yeah. I just had this time just whizzed by.
What an honor to have you on our show.
To you. And I'm going
to. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah. And you're coming to, I think, New York. I'm going to see you in New York in June.
I'm so excited. Yeah. At the Muslimish Conference. That's brilliant.
At the Muslimish Conference, which is going to be on June 23rd. Both Mariam and I will be speaking over there. So. You know, really, really, really looking forward to it.
Oh, wow. I'm jealous.
Yeah. So thanks
very much. We'll take you with us, Harvey.
We're going to try to get you there. I'm going to try to get you. Anyway, everybody, thanks for listening. Mariam, stay on for just a second. I just wanted to...
Thanks, Patrons.
Thank you, Patrons.
Thank you.
The secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends. Write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions. Or head over to secularjihadist.com and give a dollar or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.